It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's show, host Margot Patterson talked with Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, about how sentencing policies in the U.S. have created the largest prison population on the planet. After the calendar of events in the middle of the show, we air an interview that Margot conducted last December with Macy Jones and Dion Hare about Christmas in prison. Then, at the end of our show, the 420 Drug War News. Now, to Margot and Mark Maurer.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. Our guest today is Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. Established in 1986, the Sentencing Project is a national nonprofit organization calling attention to disturbing inequities in our criminal justice system and the need for reforms. Its broad range of reports documenting issues and trends in the U.S. justice system have helped shape public policy debate on mass incarceration, racial disparities in sentencing, drug policies in the U.S., problems within the juvenile justice system, and many other matters. Its staff are frequently invited to testify before Congress, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and other agencies. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
The mission of the Sentencing Project is, from what I understand, to change the way Americans think about crime and punishment. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how their ideas about crime and punishment have changed over the years and what you'd like to see them become.
Well, over the last 40 years, we've been engaged in what I sometimes think of as a grand social experiment in the use of incarceration. We've had this dramatic explosion in the number of people in prison. We have about 7 times as many people behind bars today, more than 2 million, as we did back in 1970. And the U.S. has come to be the world leader in that regard. We lock up a greater proportion of our population than any other country does. And it seems to me there's something fundamentally wrong with that, regardless of how one believes this situation came about. But the fact that the wealthiest country in the world prides itself on its democratic traditions has gotten to this point is not a good sign. And I think much of that is we've developed a very narrow view of how to deal with crime and promote public safety. You know, normally we know that these are complex problems, and people getting into trouble, violating law, it has to do with family issues, it's community support, it's economic opportunity, social networks, and also criminal justice policy. And what's happened over this period of time is that we've come to rely far too much, I believe, on the criminal justice system, law enforcement, prisons, at the expense of other kinds of interventions and support that would do a better job of promoting public safety.
One of the things I found most shocking to learn is that more and more Americans are being sentenced to life terms in prison today, and more people to life without parole. According to a report, 1 in 9 people who go to prison now receive a life sentence. This despite the fact that crime rates have been falling for the last 20 years. What explains the increasing frequency of life sentences today?
Well, our policies have become very punitive across the board. If you compare the U.S. with other industrialized nations, Canada, Western Europe, you know, we're the only one of those nations maintains a death penalty. We use life without parole, as you mentioned, far excessively than any other nations do. So it's in part, I think, an element of this so-called get tough movement. We've seen since the 1980s states adopting mandatory sentencing policies, 3 strikes and you're out, cutbacks on parole, and also increasing the use of life sentences. And many of the people sentenced to life in prison have committed serious crimes, but you also get policies like 3 strikes and you're out in California, where until the policy was amended last year, there were cases where one man had been convicted of stealing 3 golf clubs from a sporting goods store as his 3rd strike. He got 25 to life. Another man stole $153 worth of videotapes. As his third strike, he got 50 to life. So, you know, the scale of how we impose these sentences, you know, has really gone so far beyond anything reasonable, and it's been part of this sort of bidding war that we saw for many years about, you know, which political party could be tougher on crime, and, you know, had very little regard for research on effectiveness or other ways to deal with the problems or how much prison time would serve as some kind of deterrent or be appropriate for the crime. So it was really an ideological sort of soundbite battle rather than one based on real-world evidence.
Just so that listeners get an idea of how much more punitive we are today than we used to be, I think there is a report on your website that says in 1984, 35,000 people were serving life terms, and in 2012, that's grown to 159,520 people, and about 50,000 people are serving life terms without parole. What is the thinking behind sentencing so many people to life terms without parole, and are we seeing any resistance to that?
Yeah, well, I think for many political leaders and sometimes judges, you know, it may feel like almost a no-brainer that, you know, if somebody's committed a serious crime, well, if you send them to prison and never let them out, they're not going to come out and commit a new crime. So, you know, you've covered yourself in that sense, and you can say to the public, don't worry, this person is never getting out, you know, regardless of how they may change in prison or aging out of crime or being incapacitated medically in prison, all those kinds of things. So it's sort of an easy way out for some political people and some of the decision makers. It's also a very expensive way to do things. You know, it costs something like $25,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. For someone over the age of 50, the costs are often three times that amount. So as people become less likely to be involved in crime as they age, we're actually spending more and more money keeping them locked up. So it's not a terribly effective approach. Just one indication of the scale of the problem, there was a recent court decision in Europe. The European Court of Human Rights had heard a case about the imposition of life without parole in the United Kingdom. The question there, the ruling was that life without parole could not be imposed in a mandatory manner, that judges had to be able to consider the individual circumstances of the offender and the offense and to resentence some of those cases. And it caused quite a bit of discussion in Europe around this. Well, at the time the court looked at those cases, there were exactly 49 people serving these life without parole sentences in the entire United Kingdom, and that compares to 49,000 serving that in the U.S. So it's a 1,000-to-1 ratio, and yes, we have a bigger population, but it's certainly not 1,000 times larger. So the scale of how we punish, and in large part I think because of the politics of punishment in recent decades, is just really unimaginable, you know, in any other democratic nation.
Is there any evidence that lengthy imprisonment has a greater deterrent effect than shorter imprisonment?
Well, there's a lot of research in the field, you know, how much does prison contribute to crime control? And, you know, there are certainly some people in prison, Charles Manson and those kinds of people, for whom, you know, the community is at least somewhat safer because they're behind bars. But if you think about the deterrent effect, you know, does punishment make people think twice about committing crime? The research over many years tells us that to the extent the system has a deterrent effect, it's much more a question of the certainty of punishment rather than the severity of punishment. In other words, if you believe you may get caught for committing a crime, whether it's shoplifting or murder or anything in between, at least some people may think twice about going ahead and doing it. But if we just are increasing the severity of the punishment and people don't think they're going to be caught in the first place, then they're not really thinking about what that punishment looks like. So legislators have often piled on mandatory prison terms and long prison terms and told us, well, this will have a deterrent effect. There's not much evidence to suggest that's the case. If you look at something like violent offenses, about half of violent offenses are committed by somebody under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time of the offense. So it's particularly difficult to imagine that they're doing the calculation of how much time they might get in prison if they're caught. So, you know, it may make people feel good that it sounds like they're getting tough. Doesn't really do much for public safety, though. It's a real problem.
For our listeners who have just joined us, this is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and my guest today is Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. I know racial disparities in arrests and sentencing is a big problem that the Sentencing Project is concerned with. Black men in this country are far more likely to end up in prison than white men, almost six times more likely. One in three black baby boys born today can expect to spend a year in prison. What progress has there been, if any, in alleviating racial disparities in who goes to jail and prison in this country?
Well, there's been some modest progress in recent years, and much of that has been related to changes in thinking about the drug war. You know, we had a huge ramping up of drug prosecutions beginning in the 1980s. So in 1980, there were about 40,000 people in prison or jail for a drug offense. Today, that figure is 500,000. So just an enormous effect. And it was very racially skewed as well. Much of the drug law enforcement took place in low-income communities of color. In recent years, there's now, I think, more understanding about the excesses of the war on drugs, about the unwarranted racial disparities involved there. So we've seen some significant changes. The federal level, Congress 2010 passed a bill, the Fair Sentencing Act, which addressed the disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, whereby crack cocaine was punished with far harsher mandatory sentencing than was powder cocaine, and more than 80% of the people prosecuted for a crack offense were African American. So after many years of agitation and research, in a bipartisan move, Congress voted to scale back the disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentences. It wasn't eliminated, but it was reduced substantially. Similarly, in New York State, the sort of notorious Rockefeller drug laws date back to 1973, and some instances were the sort of forerunner of the war on drugs, were also scaled back significantly. And so as a result of those and similar changes, we're seeing reduced numbers of people going to prison for a drug offense, at least in some states. And just as the drug war disproportionately incarcerates people of color, as those numbers come down, it's also reducing the number of people of color for those offenses as well. So some of this change in public perception and political perception is starting to have at least a modest impact now.
Am I right in thinking there are also racial disparities among juvenile offenders in terms of who goes to prison and gets the kinds of sentences they do?
Well, very much so. And, you know, what we see in both the juvenile and the adult system is that we have a system of justice, but depending on the personal resources, the family resources you may bring to the situation, that the outcomes for two kids who commit relatively similar harms and behaviors can be very different. You know, the family who has a teenage son who's using drugs and committing crimes around that, but they can come into court and say they've got a treatment program that they can get their son into to deal with his drug problem. You know, that may be heard very sympathetically by the court as a way to deal with the problem. If there's a low-income kid and the family doesn't have those same resources, there may not be a publicly available treatment lot for that young person, and so instead he may be sent off to some period of confinement. So we've got similar problems, but the solutions can look very different with, you know, overlays of race and class very much playing into this as well.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Supreme Court ruling that affected juvenile offenders when it came to mandatory life sentences? Has that changed the situation for juvenile offenders much?
Well, in 2012, in a case called Miller that came to the Supreme Court, the question was, when juveniles are sent to life without parole, can that be done by state law in a way that's mandatory upon conviction? In other words, does the judge have to have the opportunity to take the individual circumstances into account? And the Supreme Court ruled that that was the case, that they didn't prohibit the imposition of juvenile life without parole, but they said that it had to be a case where the judges could consider all the relevant factors. And one of the most significant is that teenagers are different than adults in terms of brain development, maturity, culpability for their actions, all those kinds of questions. And so treating them exactly like adults really does a disservice both to them and to the court system. So the court ruled that they could impose that, but they had to look at all the circumstances. So there's currently a good deal of debate and legislative fighting, essentially because one unresolved issue is whether the court's ruling should apply retroactively to the more than 2,000 people in prison serving these sentences, or whether it only applies to new cases. And so far we've seen rulings on both sides of that question in the lower court, so it may come back to the Supreme Court. Just a note on the use of juvenile life without parole, there are currently about 2,600 people serving these sentences for crimes committed when they were under the age of 18. If you look at the rest of the world combined, there's not a single documented case of any juvenile serving life without parole anywhere. So either we have the 2,600 worst kids in the whole world, or else we have the most punitive policies. And I think, unfortunately, it's the latter that explains that.
Is there something about American culture that you think encourages this very punitive approach to crime and how to deal with it?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint exactly. Some people would point to, you know, sort of the frontier mentality that was, was part of the development of this country. I think one more common or current issue has to do with growing inequality that we see in our society. You know, the gap between the rich and the poor has grown quite substantially over the last 30 years or so. And, you know, one of the implications of that is that we now still live, although in somewhat different ways, in a very segregated society in many respects, where people are very much separated by race and class, both in housing and education, access to opportunity, and the like. And so in terms of any sense of the broader community, how we work together in terms of trying to understand the situations of people who don't look like us or live in other communities and the like, in many ways we are very separated, and therefore comes easier to impose these very tough sentences. You know, if you're talking about a loved one, someone we care about, putting them in a prison cell for a long time, most of us would probably think very hard before doing that. But when it looks like it's somebody else's kid, not our kid, it becomes easier to make that choice. And I think that contributes to these excesses we see in the use of incarceration.
I understand that the number of women in prison has been increasing at a rate 50% higher than that of men. What is that about?
Well, there too, much of it has to do with the war on drugs and then these rises over 25 years. The way that comes about, you know, women have always represented a fairly small proportion of the people in prison. You know, it historically been only about 3% or so. In large part, you know, women don't commit violent crimes all that often. Men overwhelmingly the ones who do that. But as the war on drugs became much more prominent in the numbers, starting in the mid-1980s, women were more likely to be involved in drug trade issues than they were in violent crime. So as there was more prosecution of drug offenders, there were more sort of women who might get swept up in those prosecutions and end up in prison. So as a result, the proportion of women in prison is basically doubled. It's gone from 3% up to about 7% today. And the average woman in prison is more likely to be serving time for a drug offense than the typical man in prison. So it's much of that coming out of the war on drug whole set of policies as well.
Am I right in thinking that the Sentencing Project advocates for alternatives to imprisonment?
Very much so. You know, certainly there are some people for whom society needs protection for some period of time, and that's why you have to isolate people from the community. But far too many people are going to prison because we just don't have the structures created in the community to supervise them appropriately and provide the services they need to deal with the underlying issues that are contributing to crime. You know, if you talk to people in corrections and prison wardens, many of them will tell you, at least privately, that, you know, a third or more of the people in prison wouldn't need to be there if we had appropriate interventions for them in the community setting. And we've gotten ourselves into a vicious cycle whereby we pour so much money into prisons, it robs resources and attention from the front end of prevention, treatment, alternatives to prison that might have much better consequences, much better outcomes for people. And so we just get into the cycle, more and more people going to prison and all the money going to the back end of the system. And that's been just very counterproductive for a long time now.
What kind of alternatives could there be?
Well, there are a range of programs and policies in place. Many jurisdictions now have drug court programs, and the idea behind these is that if substance abuse is the underlying problem in a person's criminal charges, rather than viewing prison as a first option, we should view treatment as a first option. So the court will sort of supervise a person's treatment program. If they complete successfully, they'll either drop the charges or put the person on probation, but basically trying to get at the problem in a more direct way. Many courts now use initiatives like community service work, restitution to victims, basically for less serious offenses. You know, how can the defendant pay back the community or pay back the individual victim for the harm that's been created so as to avoid the use of prison or jail, and also to get some sense of completion here, that we recognize that somebody's been harmed, so what is the responsibility of the offender to try to rectify that situation?
Well, all of those sound like they would be much more inexpensive. Is that causing communities to increasingly think about using these alternatives rather than imprisonment?
Yes, certainly the cost issue is one that's really helping to drive this conversation now, as, you know, states are really scrambling to fund higher education and other services, and increasingly recognizing they can't do that if they maintain a record scale prison population. And we're seeing this among both Democratic and Republican governors alike. And at the federal level, there's now legislation pending to reduce the scale of mandatory sentencing, and you get some very strange bedfellows supporting that. In the Senate, leading liberal Democrats like Senator Leahy, Vermont, Senator Durbin of Illinois, joining forces with Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, Tea Party people, all coming together partly around the cost issues, but partly around looking for policies that are not ineffective and counterproductive. And I think they've all come to the conclusion that long prison sentences for offenses that are not that serious just are not very helpful and really drain resources from communities.
Well, Mark Maurer, thank you so very much for talking to us.
And thanks for having me as well.
Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. This week's program features Rodney Knott, and his topic is, What is Manhood Today?
Hear this discussion on Wednesday at noon. On the next Sprouts,
Exploration of sexual assault on college campuses, including college administration's cover-ups of reports of rape, as well as Title IX suits as a new tool to fight rape on campus. That sprouts Thursday at noon.
This is the calendar for December 9th, 2013. Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will hold vigils across the state tomorrow to protest the execution of Alan Nicholson. In Kansas City, the vigil will be Tuesday, December 10th at the J.C. Nichols Fountain at 47th and Main, KCMO, from 4 to 5 p.m. This execution was originally scheduled for October, but halted because of concerns about the use of the drug propofol for legal injections. For more information, call Kathleen at 816-206-8692. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, December 14th, from noon to 1:30 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have an incarcerated loved one and are feeling overwhelmed and powerless when dealing with the criminal justice system, MIST can help. For more information, contact Beverly Livingston at 888-812-0594 or 816-337-5876. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
The following is a report from Behind the Bars by Kay Ray. You can hear these reports on the first Sunday of the month. Listen to Sunset Reggae from 6 to 8 p.m. every Sunday here on KKFI.
This is Kay Ray coming to you on KKFI 90.1 with a monthly report from Behind the Fences. This is a segment where we on the inside let you on the outside know what is going on within corrections and encourage everyone to get involved with the issues concerning family, friends, and loved ones in prison. The topic for this month is Christmas in prison. This is the holiday season where most people are mindful of forgiving past wrongs and looking forward to a spirit of renewal as the new year approaches. As I have done in the past, sticking with tradition, I hope to shed some light on what it is like being in prison during holidays. Although some prisoners handle the holiday season well, many do not. As seen last week when a guy tied a sheet around his neck and jumped over the top walk rail. It was a miracle he did not die. He was medevaced out, and that's the last we've seen of him. Some prisoners carry on like Christmas is nothing more than a good turkey meal, yet you can see the truth in their eyes when they're on the phone with their families and loved ones. They all want to be with their families at this time of year. This is the time of year when prisoners are reminded of memories spent with their families during the holidays. And with those memories come the memories of what led us to prison, as well as the forces keeping us here. Yet, for some prisoners in this cloud of loneliness and separation, the holiday spirit shines through as we send Christmas cards and do what we can to communicate with our family, friends, and loved ones on the outside. The families of the people in prison feel it especially during this season, as there's no way to ignore the missing person during the holiday meal. It is these people in the community who must endure year after year of their loved ones being in prison. This fact alone should be a stark reminder that people who have loved ones in prison are doing time also, and prison affects far more people outside of prison than those on the inside. Although it is easy to demonize prisoners and hold on to their past mistakes, it is far more difficult to do the right thing and forgive them. Only through forgiveness and empathy for all the people that prison affects will we be able to give more prisoners a chance to reenter society successfully. In looking back, there is not one person here at this prison or any other prison, not even the people who work there, that could tell you what prison was like before they came here and saw it for themselves. As they say, hindsight is 20/20. Besides, Everyone knows that 99% of all prisoners will be released one day, some for the better and some for the worse, but return they shall. I do not say any of those things seeking pity for people in prison. I just remind you to think compassionately about those who have been away for far too long and how this must affect their families, friends, and loved ones. With this in mind, I ask all of you to remember those of us who will not have a Christmas tree or presents or festivities with our families and friends. If you know someone in prison or one of their family members, please drop them a postcard or a Christmas card with a message of encouragement. These people need hope. As the DOC in Missouri continues with the unreasonable practice of keeping families and friends apart for as long as possible, even though this method has proved...
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
...has proved many times over to be a failure for society to have an unforgiving government. Missouri Corrections persist with this antique and failing social model. I hope this encourages you to write, email, or call your senators, representatives, and prison officials, reminding them of the large number of prisoners that are eligible to be released from prison, yet will miss another holiday season away from their families. Judges and prosecutors should be reminded that although your family member or loved ones are able to be released from prison, you're still not able to enjoy the holidays fully without your people being at home. I thank you for listening and encourage any or all of you to write into KKFI, P.O. Box 32250, Kansas City, Missouri, 64171, with questions or concerns regarding the issues on this program.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and we are here talking to Macy Jones and Dion Hare about what Christmas is like for the men and women serving time behind bars in our country's prisons. And Macy and Dion, could you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Yes, as you stated, my name is Macy Jones, and I was incarcerated for over 20 years, and I was in Missouri State Penitentiary. I was in Mobley Correctional Center, and I've only been out 3 years. I was released September the 29th of 2009, and September the 29th of this year made my 3 year. I celebrated that 3 years because it's beautiful to be free, you know.
And Dion.
Yes, my name is Dion Hare. First of all, I want to thank you for having me on your show. I also have been incarcerated over 20-something years. I got out in 2007. Unfortunately, I went back about 2009, but since I've been out so far, it's been a total of 19 months. Again, it's a blessing. It's definitely a blessing.
Well, before we get to talking about Christmas and how it's celebrated in prison, I'm curious, what did you two go to prison for?
I went to prison for committing of a murder.
And Dion?
Same for second-degree murder.
Well, it's December 24th, and I am very ignorant of what Christmas is like for those people in prison. Tell us from your experience what you found there. What was December 25th like?
December the 25th, for me incarcerated, was just another day. Because, when I went to prison, I didn't have any concept of ever being free again. So living in that mindset, every holiday is just that, another day.
Was Christmas celebrated?
Yes, prison was celebrated in Christmas. However, I had to make a transition into even thinking that holidays should mean anything at all.
It was celebrated to the point to where, you know, you had administrative that would take money from the inmate canteen that was allotted to even pass out so-called, they call it goodie bags and things like that. Then you had certain churches that came up in the chapel and put on programs for inmates to come and share and rejoice, things like that. And you had other organizations also, too, that maybe perhaps inmate organizations that perhaps participate in it within their own organization to celebrate Christmas also, too. But like Macy said, that Christmas, I mean, like another day, you know, you wake up, you plan your day, you hopefully that nothing happens, but also the administration also puts, like they call a little meal. It be turkey, sometimes be dressing, it really depends, you know, they might have pie, something like that, but I guess it's the thought that counts.
And when you think, if I may, and when you think the mentality of what Christmas is supposed to represent, the gathering of family, if you had children, a wife, you know, you now here you are, you sitting in a cell while they are on the other side of them walls or them fences without. And now the festive part of it seems to be diminished a little bit.
Oh, of course. Well, I'm wondering, did the prison authorities allow family visits on Christmas Day?
If I believe it's an occasion that it has been, but if Christmas falls like on a Tuesday, because currently I think right now visits are on Thursdays, Friday, and Saturday and Sunday. So by Christmas being on a Tuesday, it's 50-50, and it really depends on what level the camp is. Level 5, maybe not. Maybe level 2 camp institution, yes, it may be.
Well, tell us what these levels mean, level 5, level 2. What's that all about?
Level 5 is more your maximum security institutions. Your level 2 camps are the institutions where the custody level is not as high, the risk of wanting to get away.
and to add to that, and you have less aggressive inmates. So, and also that individuals who may come to jail for 30-year sentence, have a life sentence or life in 50, you know, those are where you'd be at the maximum security penitentiary, where the Jeff City, which is called, the street is called No More Hope.
Yeah, No More Victims.
Yeah, No More Victims. So then if you happen to get a date by the parole board, then they drop your level 2, level 4, level 3. It really depends. Because sex offenders, they can never be dropped to a level 1, level 2. They must remain as a high-level risk, period.
Well, I'm thinking that Christmas can be a difficult day for people outside prison. You know, there are so many expectations. Many people find it hard to handle the Christmas season. How about inmates? Do you think Christmas is a harder day than normal? I'm sure that there's a huge variety because everyone is different, but is that a hard day for people inside prison?
Oh, definitely, for sure, because the hardest thing about that is when you call home. When you call home and you have children, and your children are so used to you being there, providing for them, especially for this one day, and all of a sudden when you call, you hear your family in the background, you may hear children cry, laughing, things like that. That type of joy will definitely bring that type of hurt and sorrow in your heart, because then here it is. You the ones missing, especially when somebody say, hey, we having fun, brother, we this, that, but guess what? You know, everybody's here. You're the only one that's missed. That right there would drop the bomb on anybody's elevator.
A lot of us didn't call home during that time due to the simple fact that, you know, it's like getting a visit. You get a visit, and when visiting hours is over with, you know, you seeing your loved ones walk out the door, and you know, you still here. So a lot of us didn't call home because we didn't want that to make our time harder, or the emotional responses that come from hearing your loved ones over the telephone in a festive environment.
What was your daily routine like, and was it any different on Christmas? I mean, did anything change in terms of what you would normally be doing?
No, the daily routine consists of count time 4 times a day.
Now, what's count time?
Is where the officers come by and make sure that the amount of bodies are still left in the institution. If the count, take for instance, you have an institution that holds 1,800. If they got less than 1,800 there, that means somebody then got what we call ghosts or escaped or hidden or whatever, or missing. So it's like, it's like the end of the day. They got count time. Everywhere in prison is a line. If you go to breakfast in the morning, if you go to lunch, if you go to dinner, like I said, the showers will still be on. You still have people playing cards or playing dominoes, reading books. The library may not be open. The chapel will be open. Then, like I said, it's just a daily routine. Nothing changes. Everything's repetitious.
And how do you spend your time between breakfast and lunch?
Working. But on Christmas, seeing how they're, you know, we're not having to work if you didn't work in the dining hall.
So you had the day off.
Watching football.
Well, that was my question. So you'd have the day off from working on Christmas Day.
Some would have the day off.
Christmas has become for many people a secular holiday, but of course it's really a religious holiday. Are either of you Christian?
No, I'm not. I'm a Muslim. I believe in I'm a part of a Muslim faith in Islam. My background is Christianity, but as as you become older and you do your research and things, you know, you pave your own path.
And Macy?
I as well am a Muslim. However, that word Christian in the concepts of the doctrines that are being presented, I'm not Christian in that extent. But I am a Christian in the principles that come from Jesus Christ himself.
I think of prisons as being perhaps God-forsaken places. By that I mean sort of desperate places. But, of course, I would think in God-forsaken places many people might seek out God more or seek out some kind of religious faith. That sounds like maybe it was your experience. And is that common, do you think?
It's not the experience in the beginning. You know, when you sent to prison, you ain't sent to prison with any hopes. As the sign said, when we got there, leave all your hopes and dreams behind. You are now entering the Missouri State Penitentiary. So you're not going there with any ideals or concepts of having anything ever again. So in the beginning, no, that's not the common. Later on, as time passes and things begin to change and you begin to change within yourself and your attitudes and maybe begin to see some semblance of hope, then, you come into a spiritual awakening.
As a child, our mothers tell us to believe in God, to talk to God. So when you're in a prison, one thing that you're going to know, if you don't have a friend, the only friend you're going to have is who? It's God himself. Some people do take the religion and maybe for the wrong reasons, but you have to remember, you have to revert to back when your mother had taught you, is to believe.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and we are here talking to Macy Jones and Dion Hare about Christmas in prison, the role of faith for prisoners. How many years were you in prison before you started seeking out some kind of religious faith?
I was in prison 10 years before I finally decided that, hey, one day I was sitting in the cell and I said, hey, you know, if there's a God, then I'm going to ask you something. If you real manifest yourself to me, show me, give me some sign. You gave Moses one in the burning bush. You know, hey, all the time hearing people talk about God, and every Sunday morning when you cut on the TV, that every channel you turn to, you know, with some preacher on there talking and saying this about God, and God talked to him and he talked to you, okay. So I wanted him to talk to me.
Well, is there a lot of talk about God in prison with your fellow prisoners?
Definitely, for sure. You know, you always have what they call wars. And I say war, I don't mean physically. I mean, you know, mentally, where you have those individuals who doesn't understand actually the word God or don't understand what religion is. You're always going to have soul searchers, no matter where you are, in prison or out of prison. You got people out here today that's searching.
And along in accordance with what he's expressing, even among those who profess to already be either a Christian, Muslim, Jew, or whatever, they themselves have the misconcepts of each other. So in having the misconcepts of what a Muslim is, or having a misconcept of what a Christian is, here it is, the Christian and the Muslims are having dialogue as to, you know, who's right and who's wrong. And here I am, the individual that may be trying to find God. Now I'm trying to figure out where I need to be at.
Exactly.
So we sit down and we listen. So yes, there is that takes place, just like out here in society, where the Muslims are misunderstood and the Muslims are misunderstanding the Christians, and individuals talking about, you know, that they going to heaven as opposed to others going to heaven. Well, hey, you know, for a man incarcerated right now, he in hell and he trying to make sure that he can find the heaven. But then he gets them conflicts as well.
I know there are a lot of people who have become Muslims in prison. I'm curious why, what the perception of Christianity is and what the draw of Islam is.
Well, you have in prison throughout the state prisons, you have the Morrisons Temple, which is a conscious organization. They believe in what Marcus Garvey stood for and Jubal Ali. And also you have the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam, everyone knows that is headed by Farrakhan. And that took the time when the Nation of Islam came about, our people were very desperate in need for that believe in yourself. And then you have Islam. You're talking over 400 some years. even in the Bible, it speaks about Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So personally, some people do join, come in straight in the prison, join religion organizations for safety, and I hope in their heart that later on in life that they come to actually believe. Then you have some such as me and Macy, to where it took us over 10 years to actually, one, find ourselves. Second, you know, we had to stop doing the prison hustle, the prison things, that, and make sure that we got away from all the prisons, knocking, to make sure that if we take this religion, any religion we take, make sure we be serious about the religion.
Well, now, what's the prison hustle?
Oh, my goodness. I opened a can of worms, didn't I? A prison hustle can be, you know, selling cigarettes, selling coffee, selling potato chip, you know, things like that.
And along with what he was talking about earlier about Islam and why do individuals come to Islam in prison, the majority of us come from Christian background. And in coming from Christian backgrounds, you have the Christian doctrine that you receive from a child, but you never made the conscious choice yourself to accept Christianity as your way of life, because you studied it for yourself and come to know that this is best for you and suits what God had intended for you. So in coming to prison, you came as a Christian, but once you got there, you heard about Islam. And in the studying it, because see, you just can't say I'm a Muslim and that's what it is. You have to study first to know that this is what it is. So me being a Christian coming to prison, I had to study it. And in studying it, there were things that I come to find out that best suited me. To give an example, we know the story of where they talk about Jesus went into the temple and he turned the table over and whipped the people or the cows or something up out the temple, the money changers. Now, when individual hears that and then hear that Jesus turned the other cheek, now there's a conflict in the mind, and then you see in society that somebody gets smacked that says he's a Christian, but he ain't turned no other cheek. So now you're wondering, what was these principles and these teachings really all about? So in the studying of Islam, the doctrine of Jesus dying on the cross, these are the things that separate Christianity. Jesus dying on the cross is the only thing that separate a those with the label Christian from a Muslim, those with the label Muslim. When we look at the principal teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Islam, then we come to find out Jesus fast.
There's no difference. The only different variations that we actually have, or any conflict that may appear or develop between Christianity and Islam, is that when they say Jesus is the Son of God. And we as Muslims, we are known as Jesus as being noble, great prophet, never the Son of God. We never associate anybody with God himself or equal.
Because then you have to say that Mary was Jesus' mother. So what does that make her?
And in my token, I got put out of Sunday school one day because I thought that Adam should have been the Son of God. That's what deterred me away from Christianity, because the story that the question I was asking, could no one come up with them? And I think that getting put out of Sunday school at a young age was kind of, you know,
rough, was
rough. So, you know, not saying that they pushed me towards Islam, because like you said, you have to study. Like, you know, that's the difference there it is, you know, that's when a Christian said, and it's a lot of Christians that acknowledge that he's not the Son of God, or he's not God himself. You know?
You mean there are a lot of people who call themselves Christians who think that?
Right.
Yes, yes. And then I know of plenty of them that know for a fact that he, in other words, when somebody pray, they might say, oh, Jesus, and they pray through Jesus to God.
I'm wondering if the popularity of Islam has to do with the Muslim chaplains are more effective or better teachers than the Christian chaplains there?
No, the Islam really came from the men themselves that were incarcerated. This was the establishment of it. It wasn't a chaplain that had the influence. It was the men who were sitting in a cell right along with you that you seen something in his character, or you seen something about him, the peace or the tranquility that he had that made it possible for you to, hey, what you got? I need some of that, man.
Yeah.
And how do you think religious faith has helped you, or how did you see it helping other people in prison, whether it was Islam or Christianity or another religion, perhaps?
Actually, peace, humility, it humbles you. It you know, to be able to practice something that, one, will bring joy to you. When you read the history of Islam and know about the hereafter, know about the things that takes place at the hereafter, me per se, is that so many bad things have happened to me after other, you know, some people call it bad luck, some people call it karma with the K, but my life has changed. My life changed. And to say that it helped me, it made me discipline myself as far as who I am, what I want to go, what I want to do, and how to get to the things that I need to do. And also it helped me to want to better myself and present myself not only as this barbaric individual some people may perhaps think of me, but one thing about it, know that I'm a man. I learned that through education and Islam, I knew that can no number, color, nickname grade me higher than I could grade myself as a man. I learned one thing. It's not what they call me, it's what you answer to.
And it's life. Simply put it like he said, you live, you come to life. Whether you be a Christian, Muslim, if you live according to the principles, if you live according to the principles that you've been given, according to your teachings, then you come to life. Because we went in dead, you know.
Yes,
we went in
dead.
You was considered a beast, an animal. When you put somebody in a cage, when you put someone in a cage, you considering them dead. The incarcerated citizens, which we call them incarcerated citizens, when they was putting them cages, they wasn't putting them cages to live. You been to the zoo? When you see a gorilla, is that gorilla happy? You know? No. So his spirit is crushed. So the same principle applies for the incarcerated citizens. They didn't go in there alive. They went in dead. But once they heard life-giving principle, I'm going to say principle, then they came to life. Then you come to life. Now you live. When you start living, then your walk change, your talk change, and your actions change.
Reflection.
Then, after that, something else happens. The God that you say that you believe in, the one true God, makes a way for you, because now you cry out to him and you call to him and say, hey, open up these doors for me. Open up these doors. And once he opens up the doors, now you're on this side to try to be an example. See, there's been a lot of men and women that have come out of prison and don't went back. That happened. You become alive.
Dion and Macy, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Osprey Oriel Lake, author of Uprisings for the Earth. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about reconnecting culture with nature.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
This week on Interfaith Voices, the growing controversy over the spiritual roots of yoga. Is it religion, exercise, or something else?
I would say that yoga is something else. There's a lot riding on how you define a religion.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before the Jazz Disciple.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Learning from our past. Preparing in our present. To defend our future.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join me this week for Hear Me, Don't Fear Me, Youth Jam Future, the voices of youth on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Ready? One, two, three.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events or a link to our show episode and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org or at 90.1 FM. My name is Lee Moore, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
The 420 Drug War News. The following is from the TV show The Doctors. It features the mother of Charlotte V, who uses medical marijuana to stop her epileptic seizures.
The reaction's been only positive, so everyone wants to know the, you know, what are the negative things I've heard. I've actually not heard much, and again, maybe that's just not reaching me, but I think it's just an education, and we just don't understand it. So she's not smoking this.
Right.
She's not getting high. She's, you know, I think that the people who know Charlotte and saw how severe, how end of life she was, we had signed a DNR and gave up. I think that they understand, and they see her now. She can walk again. She was in a wheelchair.
Think about that. If you're watching this at home right now, Charlotte's mom, Paige, had given up, had signed a do not resuscitate because you knew your daughter was in so much pain and agony, and yet you have found something that has essentially cured her.
Yep, she'll have seizures. It's genetic. But yes, I mean, I see no negative side effects.
And Charlotte could have been here today, but it's illegal for her to cross state lines with her medication that she needs how many times a day?
She takes it twice a day.
Right.
And this is amazing to me because my opinions have changed as well. It's taken education for all of us to understand. So what are the positive attributes of medical marijuana? Because there is a difference. THC is the element of marijuana that gives people the high that we've traditionally thought of with marijuana. We're talking here about a type of cannabis that can help prevent seizures like those in Charlotte, and she's not ingesting it the way you would with normal pot. We actually have Dr. Oren Davinsky, neurosurgeon and director of NYU's Comprehensive Epilepsy Center, to join us right now via Polycom. But I think the game is changing, is it not?
I think stories like Charlotte's and the path that Paige and her husband have taken has awoken many people in medicine, and I think we now have to look at compounds like cannabidiol, which, as you mentioned, is the non-psychoactive part of marijuana, and does work in animal models of epilepsy. And we have these cases like Charlotte's that compel us to do more research and understand this compound.
And, you know, it's so important for people to understand we use plant-based medications every single day in medicine, anorexia and wasting in cancer patients. So people really do need to open their minds to the medical and therapeutic uses of these medications because they can make a huge difference for people like Charlotte.
If you're trying to pioneer new treatments and new forms of the medication that can be used, right?
As the regulatory barriers are very intense in the United States, we're going to do it because I take care of people with Dravet and other disorders, and we need to push the envelope. We need to look at other potential therapies and do careful research and study what their benefits and what their potential risks are.
Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.